Turning our attention now to a new book that's out, another new book. This one has to do with our climate. It's called Changing Planet, How the Climate Crisis Threatens Our Health and What We Can Do About It. Changing Health. Paul Epstein and Dan Ferber. Paul Epstein, a physician. Dan Ferber, journalist. And he co-authored Changing Planet, Changing Health with Dr. Paul Epstein. He writes for Science. He writes for Reader's Digest, Popular Science, and Audubon. Great to have him with us today. And certainly, I hope you'll join in with your own questions. Are you worried about diseases we used to think of as tropical, perhaps making their way to Wisconsin? Or maybe you've noticed a change in the prevalence of some disease-carrying insects and maybe in air quality. How much would you as a person be willing to change your way of life to help offset some of climate change's effects on global health? Those are all things I hope you'll think about and we'll certainly talk about as we move along today. And you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us as well at talk@WPR.org or go to the Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Dan Ferber with us by phone. Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on. Pleasure to be here.
How did writing this book allow you to tie together the sort of three elements that seem to be close to your heart, human health, healthy ecosystems, and a livable climate?
Yeah, it was a fascinating experience. I've covered, as a journalist, I've covered health, I've covered environmental stories, and I've covered science for a number of years. And this issue, just because of it is so broad, it covers the connection between climate and health. So I had to think about the changes in the global environment and the different ways why they might influence human health. And we did a lot of reporting, talked to people around the world who were dealing with these issues already, doctors and scientists and patients and other folks too.
And Dr. Paul Epstein, you wrote the book with him. He has extensive background in public health, both in the U.S. and in the developing world, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly, yeah. He's a physician, he's a public health scientist, and he's worked in Mozambique and a number of other countries in the developing world. And interestingly, he has, somewhat unusual for a physician and a public health scientist, he has moved out beyond the boundaries of the medical world and the academic world and tried to find real-world solutions to these health problems that climate change are causing or beginning to cause. And so he's worked with people in the business community and the world of international diplomacy, just whatever it takes to find practical real-world solutions.
Yeah, and his experience, I think, really shaped your work in this book.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the book is it chronicles his journey 30 years since he was a young physician, learning the field of public health so he could learn more about preventing disease, preventing health problems, and then, as I mentioned, just working more towards real-world solutions. So as Paul learns, hopefully the reader learns, and that's sort of how we put together the book.
Yeah, it's an interesting and a very nice way to put it together. Let's take a look at climate change here for a minute. We've observed it for decades, I guess. The realization that it affects human health, however, that's a little more recent, I think, a lot more recent. What were the first indications of that, and how are they discovered?
Yeah, so I think it's been in the early 90s when Paul and a number of other scientists started thinking about the connections between changes in the global environment and human health. The first signs of something different in the world were the what Paul calls the epidemic of epidemics, a lot of emerging infectious diseases that started appearing in the 1970s and late 1970s and early 1980s. And there was just some thought, there's a lot of there's global environmental change. These infectious diseases are appearing. Is there some connection? And people started digging into that, including Paul Epstein. And some of the earliest ideas and documentation of this were in infectious diseases like malaria. So Malaria is very well understood. It's a huge public health problem worldwide. People understand how the mosquitoes, a lot about the biology of the mosquitoes, a lot about the parasite that is passed from the mosquitoes to people. And so one of the things they understood is that as temperatures got slightly warmer, just 1 or 2 degrees Celsius, so 2 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit, it made a huge difference in terms of the how quickly the mosquitoes could reproduce, how quickly the parasites could reproduce, and that could mean the difference between a malaria epidemic and no malaria. So in other words, there were some places in the mountains, particularly in East Africa, that just never had malaria because it was just too cool for the mosquitoes. And some scientists were predicting that as it got warmer, we'd start seeing malaria in those areas. And I actually traveled around Kenya, central Kenya, with one of those scientists, a man named Andrew Gatheko, who made these predictions in the 1990s. And he was interested in whether it was really happening. And in fact, it was happening. And it affected his family personally. So these are the projections started in the 1990s. We're starting to see a lot of these effects now.
How widespread do you think awareness of these impacts is among, and let's say, medical professionals and scientists and maybe policymakers and the general public?
That's a great question. And it's growing. So when we started this book, we started working on this book about 3 years ago, and at that point, a number of major medical organizations have issued warnings, and it's only been since 2007. The American Public Health Association was the first, and then the American Medical Association, the American Nurses Association, and on and on. And so the medical profession is just catching on, but it's catching on at the high levels, and that is still filtering down to your average doctor or nurse at a community clinic, say. And I've spoken to some of these people, and there are people trying to get the message out to the kind of rank and file in the medical community. In the larger public, I think that there has been some coverage in the past couple of years. The idea is getting out there, particularly with things like heat waves and infectious disease. But there are some other effects that we go into in Changing Planet, Changing Health that are more surprising, I would say, links between climate change and health.
Yeah, I want to talk about some of those surprising ones. But let me first remind everybody, if you're listening in, you have a question or a comment, you want to throw your own 2 cents worth in here, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And let's talk about some of those surprises.
Sure. I think the most obvious or expected thing that happens that is a health effect from climate change is it's getting warmer, so heat waves are getting more intense and longer, and that is in fact the case. And heat waves are a big public health problem in this country. They actually kill more people a year, 1,500 people a year. That's more than hurricanes and tornadoes and earthquakes and floods combined. So that's heat waves. And there's a very striking fact about heat waves that it just sort of knocked my socks off when I heard it, is that if we keep doing what we're doing, we can expect a heat wave like Chicago in 1995 every summer on average by the 2040s if we don't change course. But some of these other, some of the surprising links between climate and health, respiratory disease, allergies and asthma. So as we're burning all of this coal, oil, and gas, it produces carbon dioxide, which goes into the atmosphere. And it turns out, and this was discovered by Paul Epstein, as a matter of fact, and a scientist named Louis Ziska at USDA about 10 years ago, that if by all this extra carbon dioxide produces the ragweed plant, which is the main cause of fall allergies, produces more pollen. And not only that, but the pollen is more potent in terms of causing allergies. So that was completely unexpected. And it's a way that, and a lot of people are allergy sufferers, hay fever sufferers, so there is a documented link between the changing atmosphere, which is the result of burning fossil fuels, and the allergies. And in the case of asthma, A lot of the air pollutants that are a product of burning these fossil fuels, so we're talking about the types of air pollutants the EPA regulates, the NOx gases that produce ozone in the atmosphere, which is the main ingredient of smog, and the black soot that comes out of truck exhaust, those particles, very bad for the respiratory system, for the lungs. They get in there and they irritate the lining of the lungs. So that can trigger asthma attacks. And so you have several different ways to aggravate respiratory disease. And that was somewhat surprising to me. And there's some others, too. I mean, as the coastal oceans warm, and there are more outbreaks of harmful algal blooms, red tides, and things like that, and that can cause gastrointestinal problems and even things like amnesia and temporary amnesia. So very unexpected things that are happening as we disrupt the ecosystems around us because the climate is changing quickly.
Well, we'll take some calls and allow some listeners a chance to get in here. Let's go to Bill in Winneconne. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. It's a very important topic, I think. I have a somewhat darker question. I worked in New Guinea for many years a while ago, and they had just stopped using the spray they use for malaria, anyway, DDT, and there's still powder on the walls of some of the buildings, outbuildings that I've used. And my question is, in many of the tropical areas, the countries that are in these areas have relatively high or very high birth rates, Kenya being one example. What will be the side effects of malaria control if it reduces the death rate? What effect will it have on population growth, and what will that have upon other issues, political or environmental?
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a great question.
That's a great question, yeah.
So I think the answer is it depends on how you control malaria. So when I was when I visited Kenya, I traveled with Dr. Andrew Githeko to investigate. He was investigating malaria in central Kenya, but I also visited his lab in western Kenya, where they are developing ways of controlling malarial mosquitoes that are safer than something like DDT. So these biological insecticides, or at least more environmentally benign insecticides, they're being developed and they're being tested and being used. So I think the answer to the question is it depends on what is used. DDT is not the only option anymore. There are other options that are safer for people.
And with that, we'll take a quick break for a look at the news, weather, and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. And then we'll be right back with Dan Ferber, author of Changing Planet, Changing Health. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at the climate, how the climate crisis threatens our health, what we can do about it. That's the subtitle of the book, Changing Planet, Changing Health. It was written by Dan Ferber, journalist. He co-authored it with Dr. Paul Epstein. He writes for Science, Reader's Digest, Popular Science, and Audubon. And so it's great to have him along to talk about his book and, you know, what's happening and what we can do about it. And, you know, that's an important part of this as well. I hope you'll join in with your own comments and questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And Dan, we recently spoke with Amy Stewart, who is the author of the book Wicked Bugs. And she talked about how mosquitoes kill more humans worldwide than any other insect. And you have a chapter called The Mosquito Bite. And maybe we can talk a little more about the connections between climate change, mosquitoes, and threats to human health.
Sure. The connection between climate change and is one or two. They're the rising temperature lets mosquitoes that carry disease live in a broader area. So this is areas that used to be too cold for them, further away from the equator and higher in the mountains. And we talked a little bit before about the mosquitoes that carry malaria. In closer to home, at least in the Western Hemisphere, we have the mosquitoes that carry dengue fever, which is another very big global health problem. And it's rampant in the Caribbean, in Central America, in Mexico, and it is actually moving northward into this country. We had an outbreak in Key West, Florida in 2009. That was the first in 65 years. Dengue fever is also called breakbone fever. It's a very painful disease. It's like a very bad case of the flu. And most people recover from it, but if you get it a second time, it can be potentially fatal. So those are the two biggest diseases, malaria and dengue fever. But there are many other diseases that are carried by mosquitoes that are moving to new areas. West Nile fever is a mosquito-borne disease, but it's spread in a different way because when it's linked to the extreme weather. So if you have particularly wet, warm conditions, it likes that sometimes. And also, sometimes even when it's dry, the mosquitoes that carry the West Nile fever, they like these mucky puddles that sometimes develop when conditions are drying out. So actually, that's how it got to start in New York in 1999. It was during a dry summer. So those are a couple of mosquito-linked diseases that are close to home, and there are others as well.
Tom in Arbor Vitae has a question or comment. Let's go to Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Over the years, the first time I come up to the northern part of the state when I went in business, it was, well, naturally, as beautiful as can be, and I was right on the Wisconsin River. And for the first 4 or 5 years, from 91 to around 97, I'd never have any problem walking down to the docks and bringing all kinds of action from greenacre frogs and seeing the turtles trying to get away, getting off their logs to get back in the water. And by the time 97 rolled around, I didn't see that no more.
No.
So over that five-year period of time, 6 years, and even with my swallows, my houses for the swallowbirds, and they left in 97 even halfway through their breeding time.
Yeah.
Now, that was by me. And the bats that you would normally see at night with my lamps that stay on outside all the time, these power lights, which draw so many bugs and then spider webs, and then naturally this all draws. I didn't see a tenth the amount of bugs, and I didn't see a tenth the amount of bats.
Well, Dan, you know, these could be indications, although they're, you know, we're talking here, Tom's talking about his local little area, but
right.
These are some of the kinds
of... Probably a beautiful area.
Yeah, it sure is. These are some of the kinds of things that lead people to say, yeah, you know, climate, things are changing.
Yeah, and I think it's great to notice these. I mean, notice these changes, because I think more and more people are noticing these changes when the birds come in the spring, when trees flower out, and you know those sorts of things. And you know, because they are changing.
Thanks, Tom. Steve in Richland Center, we turn to you next. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to give the guest a chance to deal with, I think, the biggest problem, which is the climate change deniers out there. And so I'd like to do a little role-playing and pretend that I'm one of those deniers and say, Rush Limbaugh told me that there ain't no such thing as climate change.
So okay. How do you respond to something like that, Dan?
How do I respond? Well, you know, I'll tell you how I respond. I would respond by talking about the evidence that it's happening. So, and there's three types of evidence. One type is that we've known from chemistry and physics for 150 years that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere acts like a blanket over the atmosphere and warms the earth. That's the reason we can live here. It's part of that's the greenhouse effect. It's a good thing, you know. It would be too cold otherwise. But if there's too much of it, then it's like having a couple extra blankets on. So that's theory. Then you go around and take thousands of temperature measurements around the world for decades on decades that are showing an increase. And that's hard documented fact. Then finally, the climate models, which is what the skeptics like to attack the most, they are the way you know that the way we know that they actually work is you can take conditions from 100 years ago, the various conditions that were existing then, and plug them into the models. The models take into account the variations in the sun and the volcanic emissions that affect climate change if there's a big volcanic eruption and all of the carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases. You take the past conditions, you predict for the next 100 years up to now, and you get a perfect correlation, which means that we can trust these models. But if you take away all the greenhouse gases that we're pumping into the atmosphere, it doesn't fit at all. So it's a very, very clear indication that this is a problem that's caused in part by natural variation and in part by what we're pumping into the atmosphere.
There you go, Steve. Something to work with. Carolyn in Wisconsin Rapids, turning to you next. Hi, Carolyn.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about Lyme's disease, and I've been thinking about this since your program came on, and I was interested in the fact that he intended to talk about Lyme's disease. The reason I'm calling is our little fox terrier was diagnosed Lyme's disease in February, and when I went in, the vet told me that he had 8 patients with Lyme's disease. I don't know what stages they were at, but our little dog was had a hip dysplasia, and when she couldn't jump up onto a chair, we thought it was the hip problem. And that's all that we saw in the way of symptoms. I guess, and by the time we got her in, she had lost 3/4 of her kidney function. And then in reading a little bit about it in simple little handouts that are in every vet's office, I found out that that's the usual stage when people bring their dogs in. And I was told that if it was treated earlier, you could give the antibiotics and it would knock down the parasites. But once you've got Lyme's disease, I was told that you have it forever in a low level. And it's going to raise its ugly head, and you have to be on top of things. I am surprised that this isn't a routine check in vet's offices, because it only took 10 minutes for him to tell me. Yes.
Yeah. Well, comment, Dan?
I don't really know too much about Lyme disease in dogs, so I can't really comment too much about that, but I can say something that Lyme disease has spread in this country in part because of climate change, and it's more common in northern areas like New Hampshire and Maine than it was 10 years ago, and that's because the tick, as with mosquito before, the tick can also live in areas that used to be too cold for it. I'm not really don't have the veterinary expertise to comment on the dog, but I sure hope that your dog is doing better.
Thank you very much for calling, Carolyn. Appreciate your call. Of course, Wisconsin is a hotbed for the deer tick and for Lyme disease, so it's on a lot of people's minds here, and it's gotten worse. Jim and Hudson has a question or comment. Hi, Jim.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling.
See, I listen to so many of your programs. You know, they talk about food shortages and how to improve agriculture to feed more people, and then global warming and all this. And it seems to me that this is all symptomatic stuff. It's got all, I think the big problem has to do with overpopulation and lack of birth control. And I know it's a hot button issue. Nobody wants to deal with it. But, you know, they talk about, well, and the population of the world is projected to triple within the next umpteen years or whatever. And that's the problem. You know, I don't know. Nobody addresses that. So back to you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. And Dan, comment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, population is supposed to, it's projected to go to about 9 billion people by mid-century. So some of the solutions that we propose in this book get at this problem in a kind of a roundabout way. I mean, one of the things that people in the world of development and public health know that if you start educating girls around the world, they grow up, family sizes tend to shrink. and also poverty tends to increase family size. So some of the international solutions that we talk about, changes to the international financial architecture, get at this by promoting equity in the developing world, promoting fairness so that people have the basics that they need just to live. So I think it's an important point, and I think that as Americans we have to be conscious of the lives of people in other parts of the world, and that's part of the solution.
Thanks again for calling. You can join in, too, with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@WPR.org. I want to talk about some more of those solutions, but just a couple of more. I know forests, for example, play an important role in our ecosystems, and they are being threatened by climate change.
Yeah, it's a really interesting link, and so I actually traveled to Yellowstone and out west. I'm sure a lot of the listeners have been out west and seen the results of these bark beetle infestations in a lot of western forests, of evergreen forests. And so these bark beetles are kind of like the mosquitoes. It gets a little warmer. They can live in areas they couldn't live before, and they're wiping out entire stands of pine forest, and at the high elevations, it's white bark pine. At the lower elevations, it's lodgepole pine. And that, combined with drying conditions, warming conditions, you end up with stands of dead trees, and they go up in flames. So the forest fires are getting bigger, and there is a documented link to climate change. Of course, fires themselves are potentially dangerous, but also in the West, smoke is from forest fires is the biggest air pollution problem. And then that comes back around in terms of respiratory problems, bronchitis, aggravating asthma attacks, and also raising the risk of heart attacks if you're exposed, like other forms of smoke and air pollution do. So that's the link to forests. And also, you know, we get our clean, clear water from forests. They do good things for us. And by damaging the forest, particularly in the West, you are diminishing the supply of water in the summer because the snowpack is kind of like a reservoir. So, yeah, a couple of ways that works.
Carolyn in Madison has a comment or question. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Say, this is a really interesting program. I just wanted to piggyback on something that the guy said about overpopulation. I really think we can't forget that it's the people in the developing, and not developing, but developed countries that have caused the greatest amount of greenhouse damage. Yes, overpopulation is an issue, but the way we live is an even bigger issue.
Yeah.
Carol, I agree with you totally. I mean, contributed more than our share of greenhouse gases, of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. And I think we have a responsibility, being a wealthy country, and other wealthy countries do as well, to go above and beyond in finding solutions.
And thanks, thanks again for coming. What can the average person do? This is something from an email, Siri. What can the average person do about climate change? I know that enormous amounts of carbon pollution come from energy-intensive industry, so it's easy to feel like there's not much we can do to tip the scales.
Yeah, and that's a great question. And there's a ton we can do, just as individuals. So starting with the car we drive and the houses we live in. So we can drive a more fuel-efficient car. We can buy a hybrid, perhaps. We could get a battery electric car. At home, we can get an energy audit, weatherize, all sorts of ways of making your home more energy efficient that you can find in a lot of places online. Buy Energy Star appliances, things like that. Unplug your extra freezer that if you don't need it. Choose the compact fluorescent light bulbs. All sorts of those things. Plant trees. One of the things I always suggest when I'm asked this question, which is a great question, is let our representatives in government, let them know that we care about climate change and finding solutions, and that this is not some kind of peripheral issue. This is about the providing a livable environment for our children and our grandchildren. This is a very, very important issue, and we need to hold our representatives' feet to the fire, frankly, to get them going to find some solutions.
It does seem that we have kind of been stalled. Maybe that's just my impression, but it seems like we've been kind of stalled at the political or at the policymaking level in terms of responding to climate change.
Absolutely, yeah, it's so true. The biggest logjam is in Washington. I'll tell you what's the most exciting things that I've seen. And we also talk about solutions that towns and cities are doing, and that to me was the most exciting thing that I found really with this book. I mean, Chicago, for example, it was a leader in putting in a climate action plan. I'm not sure if Madison has one. Maybe you can tell me if they do. But the things like bike lanes and planting more trees and smart growth so that you have mixed use, walkable neighborhoods where businesses exist, where people live, so they don't have to commute 50 miles to work, that sort of thing. All of those things are really important solutions, and they go a long way towards fighting climate change and preserving health in the long term. So very exciting stuff.
Sarah in Zion, Illinois, we turn to you now. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. Hi. Well, I've read but just really briefly, so I didn't understand what it was, about like some sort of management technique that biologists could use to help natural ecosystems weather climate change. Like I read about one climate change. I read about something out in Minnesota prairies, and then something I think about forests around here. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
I'm afraid I don't know particularly. I think it would have to be on an ecosystem by ecosystem basis, because the response of a grassland might be different from a response of a forest. So if I had a little more information, I might be able to run with that. I'm not quite sure where to go with it.
Yeah, well, all I read was the title of a talk, like mitigating climate change in Midwest prairies and techniques they could use. And I just thought, well, how is that possible? But
it sounds fascinating. I'd love to learn more about it.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, thanks. Someone else may have a quick comment on that or have read that article. Alan in Rockford, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Alan.
Hello. I'm just following up. You were talking about migration of ticks possibly due to climate change. And I've noticed in Rockford, I've lived there 11 years and have never had a tick problem, but this year I've had dozens of dog ticks. Just being out in the yard a few hours, I average one or two ticks each time I'm out.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
And that's the kind of thing that I think some scientists point to as, all right, the climate is changing. When you see changes in insects and other animals in their behavior and where they are located, that certainly tells us that things are changing.
Absolutely.
Thanks again for calling. And Chris in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I just wanted to say that a lot of this seems to be a not in my backyard. It's good for somebody else to do somewhere else, but not in our own backyard. It seems to me if we were really serious about, you know, getting our food organically and you know, the smart agricultural type things, we would replace the silly ornament trees in our UW campuses and plant community gardens and apple trees and require students to help raise the food that they eat in the commons rather than having it trucked in from outside.
Hmm.
I think that's a really important point that you make. Focus on the local food. And cutting back on food mile, how far these foods are trucked in or flown in, or grapes from Chile or whatever. I mean, those are ultimately destructive to the planet. So I think it's important to for us to grow more food locally and support our local farmers, and it builds community as well. So it's a win-win solution. Many of these solutions are win-win solutions.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as a sort of response to that, I know at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, there is a fairly good-sized group of students who have started garden projects for their own use, but also for the use of other people in the community. And so they're learning about growing and harvesting and the results, the fruits of their labor are turning into great meals for members of the community outside of the student community and also within the student community. So That's one of those things we can all do, isn't it, Dan?
Absolutely. It sounds like a great effort, and it's happening at a lot of university campuses around the country. It's a fairly new movement the past 5 years or so, and it's really exciting.
Well, Dan, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I know you're going to be at an event at the University of Wisconsin on Thursday, as a matter of
fact. Thursday at noon at the Health Science Learning Center, authors at HSLC at noon on Thursday, correct? And I'll be speaking also 7 o'clock that evening at Neighborhood House. So 2 talks on Thursday.
Oh, thank you so much, Dan. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you. It's been great being here.
Dan Ferber, author of Changing Planet, Changing Health. Fascinating look at how the climate crisis threatens our health. And we didn't talk as much about what he talks about in the book of what we can do about it. We probably should have spent more time on that. We did spend a little time, but could have spent more. But great to have him along. And great tomorrow. Look forward to Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. I think we got a howling coyote or something, recording that he brought that you'll hear tomorrow on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.